The BBC presents An Actress and Her Public, a talk in which Dame Edith Evans considers the responsibilities of her art and her relationship with the people to whom it is offered.
I suppose the actor's first responsibility is to be a good actor. And for acting, as for any other art, there are two basic essentials. First, talent, and second, training to develop that talent. Talent for acting consists of a special kind of intelligence and a particular kind of temperament in which there is an urge to communicate ideas and feelings. In fact, as in any other work, if acting is the job for you, then there is a continual enthusiasm, and all your faculties automatically go in the right direction, and you feel you are flowing with the stream toward your real haven and goal. Moreover, you feel at home on the stage. You feel that this is where you belong and nowhere else. But then there's training. And to ask an actor how he learnt is like asking a cook how he learnt cooking. The actor learns to use his voice, expressions, gestures, and movements. The cook learns how many ounces of flour or rice or butter to use. But there soon should come a time when these things become instinctive. And just as the cook will discard his scales and measuring bowls, so the actor will have forgotten the exact words of wisdom he learned at school. It should become a part of them in each case. And by that time, neither cook nor actor finds it at all easy to talk very coherently about their art. One learns certain basic rules, but after that it is very much a case of finding one's own way. Well, that's all I'm going to say about the basic essentials, inborn talent and acquired skill. I want now to get on to some wider aspect of the responsibility of the actor as an artist. His first and immediate responsibility, of course, is to his author. And when the author is a great dramatist of the past, the responsibility is considerable. I should like to speak here about the Shakespearean drama. In the 18th and 19th centuries, actors used to take one of Shakespeare's plays and manipulate it solely to give themselves a chance of showing off their acting ability. Anything they didn't fancy was pared away, and if they didn't think Shakespeare had given them enough, some bit of business would be added to the text, which emerged at the end almost unrecognizable. The spectacular productions that had become customary in the 19th century were continued into the early years of this century by Beerbohm Tree. But with the new century, my old master, William Pearl, and Ben Greet, looking back to the Elizabethan theatre with its minimum of scenery, began a series of productions in which the plays could be given practically in their entirety by doing away with the frequent intervals required for scene shifting. It is still not practicable to present full-length versions of some of Shakespeare's plays. Modern working hours, meal times, and the tyranny of the last train, bus, or tube make these things inadvisable in the commercial theatre. But today, at least, Shakespeare is given reasonably fair and balanced productions, with cuts made solely for reasons of time, and not out of personal ambition, intellectual vanity, prudery, or commercialism. It is the actor's first responsibility to his author to guard this honorable and still young tradition. The main danger to Shakespearean drama today comes from actors and producers discovering psychological motives and attitudes never intended by Shakespeare himself. I would like to suggest that on the whole, Shakespeare's characters are quite clearly enough drawn to be able to stand on their own feet. To my mind, it distorts or obscures Shakespeare's plays when the actor decides to demonstrate some elaborate, new, and generally unsung theory in his performance of, say, Hamlet, or Lear, or Macbeth. Next, to respect for the author's text, comes respect for the author's style. An actor or actress must not obscure or destroy by their performance the particular style of the play, whether it is in verse or in prose. It is often tempting to, so to speak, loosen up the lines by slight modifications of words or intonation. But it is hardly ever permissible without the author's agreement. In consultation and sympathy with one's author, and a true understanding of what he's trying to say in his play is all important. Author and actor, in fact, must work together, help each other. The actor may be puzzled by some aspect of the character he is to play, and sometimes he may go to the author and say, I don't think you meant that when you wrote it. It seems to me to go like this. And he gives his own interpretation. And perhaps the author will say, well, I'm not quite sure what I meant here. What do you think? And you get the whole thing cleared up in that way. I was the original Orinthia in Shaw's The Apple Cart before the war. It was sometimes difficult to see what he meant, but I do remember one bit of help he gave me. I was seeing Orinthia as a sort of larky person, would have perhaps made her a little too young or too commonplace. But one day at a rehearsal, Shaw, who'd been watching, came up to me and said, remember, she's a goddess, you know. And of course he was right. Orinthia was not just an ordinary flirtatious woman. And by Shaw telling me she was a goddess, I got myself more physically truly into the part and said things as they should be said. But whether there is an author to consult or not, the actor must study the part until he knows the character so intimately that he can really be that person. It is absolutely essential for the actor to be completely at rest with the part he has to play. I can't imagine any greater strain than that of playing a part which you either don't understand or which you don't find convincing or consistent. I'd like now to say a few words about the actor in relation to the producer. And as I thought about this talk, more and more I felt that the essential need of any actor is to have the wish to cooperate. Cooperate with his author, cooperate with his producer. The actor must understand exactly what the producer is trying to do, the effect for which he is striving. If he's in disagreement with the producer, he must discuss the point with him, and they must reach agreement. I come now to the stage at which the actor meets his audience. Audiences differ from night to night. It may be something in the newspapers, it may be the weather, but whatever it is, their reaction is never the same, and is often quite unexpected. But from the rise of the curtain, the actor must be contacting them across the footlights, appealing, persuading, directing, and controlling their response to the play. Somehow or other, the audience must be drawn into the performance. Somehow, a current must flow backwards and forwards across the footlights, a magnetic current crossing and recrossing. The actor must get the feel of the audience the moment he comes on the stage, and he must continually lead them or they'll be bored. It's like a child. If you're reading to them too slowly, they can so easily get ahead of you, and they're always on the next page before you. And they're not listening to you because they already know what's coming. An awful lot of things have been said about how we hear by recognition. We know how a thing will finish when it starts. And if the audience recognizes a phrase at the beginning, and you drag it out and go on at long length, longer than normal, then you'll have your audience waiting for your next phrase, or going to sleep. I often think of the actor and the audience working together like a skilled horseman and his horse. If the audience are not reacting, well, you must just spur them on. But if they are reacting too generously, you must, just by your acting, bridle them. Sometimes I'm asked to what extent the actor must be involved in the emotions of the character he's playing. And all I can reply to that is we must at once be inside the character and outside it. We must feel all the grief or happiness of the part, and yet in the midst of it all, we must still be able to watch ourselves doing it, seeing ourselves through the eyes of the audience. The audience's opinion means more than anything else. And above all, we should never use the phrase, it was a bad audience. There are no such things as bad audiences. The audience pays to come and see us, and it's nobody's fault but our own if they go to sleep or miss the point. There are 1,000 things we can do to win their sympathy, and only one that is applicable at any particular moment. And the knowledge and judgment of which and when is something that can come after years of experience, but will never come if there is not in the actor deep inside that elementary quality which at the beginning of this talk I called talent. And talent, I repeat, is something no drama school or stage experience can give you if you haven't got it already. And what else do I want to say? Acting is in large part an expression of love and understanding. We actors love watching and observing and understanding the way people feel and behave. We do indeed believe that all the world's a stage, and every moment of our lives we are storing up impressions and discoveries about the human mind, the human face, and the human body. And then later, if our author has written such a part, it all links up, and we find we can live it. So that though we don't consciously imitate people on the stage, there are old memories that someday will emerge to shed their light on some problem of interpretation that otherwise might have baffled us. For actors, the stage is indeed a part of life, of that universal rhythm to which their senses must be continually attuned. And it is the actor's responsibility not to imitate life, but to interpret and distill it through his art. And he can't do this unless he develops to the full his human experience and understanding. I was very much put on my guard about this by a good friend years ago. She looked very young, and she was very fond of the theatre. And she said to me, "When I go to the theatre and I see women on the stage, sometimes I feel like saying to them, 'You don't know as much as I do.'" And I've never forgotten her words. Naturally, this makes it particularly hard for the young actor without much experience. But if he starts out with an instinctive understanding and sympathy, he should manage all right. Here again, it is love and understanding of humanity that comes into play. My own career would have gone very wrong from the ordinary point of view. When I was a young player, I had to play all heavy character parts, such as old maids and fat duchesses. But I think I had that understanding of older people, and so it helped me, and I only needed training and discipline. And it was training and discipline that I had to acquire before I played my first big part, that of Mrs. Millamant in The Way of the World. Now, one last thing. The very earliest actors were priests, taking part in a religious rite in which the audience joined in a communal act of worship. And I would suggest that still today there must be something of an act of worship, of communion in the relation of actor and audience, in which both must play their part as celebrants. The theatre celebrates not some dogmatic faith, but simple faith in humanity and love of humanity in all its aspects. The rite consists in the mere act of feeling together, whether it is laughing or crying. And in this act, it is the actor who has the privilege and the responsibility for the central role, that of kindling and cherishing the fire and of communicating its light and warmth. And it is not in the praise of the critics and the newspapers next morning, nor in the applause at the fall of the curtain that we find an assurance that we are meeting our responsibilities, but during the play itself, in some moment of silence that unites us, author, actor, producer, and every single member of the audience, making the great theatre suddenly become a small and private room where everything for a moment is made clear and brilliant as the light of day.
That talk by Dame Edith Evans was presented by the BBC.